when we get lightning, you know, typically out in the southwest Alaska is where we see a lot of fires.
11 new wildfires ignited over the weekend, including a 1,000-acre blaze near Dillingham. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, June 5th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, there will be no confirmation well drilled this winter on what may be the biggest Alaska oil find in decades.
You know, there are certain external factors that play into making a large decision like that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you're one of the 120,000 Alaskans with some college but no degree, the Finnish College Alaska Initiative at the University of Alaska Southeast offers a degree program with flexible online learning and a personalized degree plan. UAS is now offering a 3-credit tuition waiver for eligible applicants. Apply for the fall semester by Tuesday, August 1st. Learn more at finnishcollege.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
After an entire regular session and more than half a special session gone with no deal on a state budget, Governor Bill Walker met with legislative leaders today to roll out a compromise package. Under the governor's proposal, people who work in Alaska would pay a set amount each year based on their income under a compromise Walker introduced today. The concept, known as a, quote, head tax, is based on a proposal by Fairbanks Republican Senator Click Bishop. But Walker wants to raise twice as much as Bishop proposed. Under Bishop's proposal, the tax would range from $50 for people who earn less than $20,000 to $500 for those paid more than $500,000 in annual salary. Governor Walker also called on lawmakers to pass the Senate's version of an overhaul to the state's oil tax credit system with one change. It's known as ring fencing. Oil and gas companies would no longer be able to reduce their taxes due on one field by their costs to develop another. Walker also endorsed the Senate version of a bill to draw money from the permanent fund to pay for state government. That would set dividend checks at $1,000. But Walker supported the House version of the state budget. The governor's compromise package would reduce the gap between what the state spends and what it raises by nearly 90%. State government will shut down on July 1st if lawmakers can't reach a compromise by then. The Alaska Interagency Coordination Center reports 11 blazes were started by lightning strikes over the weekend. Three fires are being fought along the Kuskokwim River in the vicinity of Aniak, Crooked Creek, and Takotna. Another fire about 40 miles northeast of Dillingham grew to 1,000 acres by Sunday. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
The fire was likely sparked by lightning Friday or Saturday. Tim Mowry, a spokesman with the State Division of Forestry, says several pilots called in the fire's existence Saturday and McGrath-based crews responded.
We went and checked it out. They sent a plane out there with smoke jumpers. They first saw it. It was about 25 acres, and they went to fuel up in Dillingham and came back, and it had grown to 100 acres. But it's in a limited protection area. And given the size of it at that point, they decided that they're just going to monitor this thing, and there was nothing threatened by it.
When crews checked the fire Saturday night, it had grown to 800 acres, and by Sunday, it had grown to 1,000. It's in the vicinity of Oxtecock Lake, but is several miles away from the nearest cabin.
It's mostly burning in, tundra, black spruce, and some mixed hardwoods, but not too active, minimal activity.
Mowry says the cool spring has made for a slower start than usual to Alaska's wildfire season.
It has been a really slow start to the fire season, one of the slowest that a lot of people that have been here for many years can remember. It was a cold April and sort of a cold, wet May. But in this last week, things have warmed up. We haven't had any precip really around the interior too much, and we're just starting to pick up fire activity now. And when we get lightning, typically out in the southwest Alaska is where we see a lot of fires.
Again, the Kanakachuk Creek fire is believed to have gone past 1,000 acres and is being monitored but not directly responded to. Mowry says there are assets, including smoke jumpers staged in McGrath, to tackle wildfires in southwest Alaska this summer. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
The company behind what may be Alaska's biggest oil discovery since the 1960s will not be drilling a well to confirm the find this winter as originally planned. Last October, with great fanfare, Kaelus Energy announced it found 6 to 10 billion barrels of oil beneath the North Slope's Smith Bay. If developed, the company said the field could increase the amount of oil going down the Trans-Alaska pipeline by 40%. At the time, the company said it would release crucial final tests on the discovery in 2018. But today, Kaelus spokesperson Casey Sullivan confirmed that those plans have changed.
Our goal really is to get out there as soon as possible. But, you know, there are certain external factors that play into making a large decision like that.
Sullivan says Kaelus won't be drilling the appraisal well this winter for financial reasons. First, oil prices have stayed lower than the company anticipated. Second, Sullivan says the ongoing oil tax policy debate in the legislature made drilling appraisals well too risky.
Without knowing quite what the rules are or the clarity around funding of past tax credit payments and things of that nature, it just creates a lot of uncertainty. And for a program like Smith Bay, which really is a significant undertaking that takes a lot of front loading and logistics, we really need that sort of certainty to be able to pull off a program like that.
Kaelus has said the state owes it hundreds of millions of dollars in tax credits. State lawmakers originally designed the credits to attract small private companies like Kaelus to the North Slope to increase oil production. But due to the state's fiscal crisis, the legislature is currently locked in a debate over reforms to Alaska's oil tax system, and changes to oil tax credits seem likely. Sullivan says Kaelus still believes Smith Bay is a world-class discovery, but he couldn't say when the company will be able to return to the North Slope to confirm it. City of Fairbanks Mayor Jim Matherly is trying to address a local police officer shortage with an incentive bonus program. An ordinance to entice officers currently working in other jurisdictions is being introduced to the Fairbanks City Council tonight. As KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, the proposal comes as a disputed police contract remains before the Alaska Supreme Court.
Mayor Jim Matherly says the ordinance he'll introduce under new business at tonight's City Council meeting has nothing to do with the police contract the city has been fighting for years. That contract dispute is before the state's highest court, with the city and police union awaiting a date to orally argue their sides. Matherly says tonight's ordinance addresses a long-standing concern.
What I've been doing since day one is working pretty closely with the police department to raise their staffing levels, like right now.
Matherly says he's looking at ways to get police on streets as soon as possible. His incentive program targets experienced police officers in other departments who can move laterally. Also before the council tonight is the second reading of a city contract with the AFL-CIO for pipe fitters and other positions. The contract offers a slight salary bump. The mayor guesses the contract will be approved, but along with the new firefighters contract the city council approved last month, the city budget will be strained, especially in the fall, he says.
I've asked the council to knuckle down with me to find new revenues, cut expenses, and get ready for the impact of the fireman's contract in the fall.
The AFL-CIO contract is up for public comment at tonight's meeting, which starts at 7 p.m. in council chambers. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
For the second time in as many months, Alaska's largest communications company suffered statewide outages due to alleged criminal activity. This time, however, a man is behind bars for causing damage to GCI equipment at the Denali Tower building in Midtown Anchorage. Brody Iguarez-Lee faces felony charges for criminal mischief, burglary, and assault. GCI Director of External Affairs Megan Baldino says the company was able to minimize the impact to customers.
The individual was able to break in and damage some equipment, which caused an interruption of services. GCI teams responded almost immediately, as quickly as they could, and were able to restore all of the services by late yesterday afternoon.
According to the charges, Iguarez-Lee broke into the communications room by damaging a security code keypad and jamming metal into a keyhole. The charges say he came at a GCI employee with a large screwdriver after causing what the company described as millions of dollars in damage. Iguarez-Lee allegedly told a GCI employee that he is Lucifer and that he was there to fix the machines. Iguarez-Lee appeared in court today and seemed unaware of the seriousness of the charges, which, if he's convicted, carry a minimum sentence of several years in prison. When a judge set the bail at $25,000, Iguarez-Lee shook his head in disbelief.
So what's going to happen next? Am I getting out of here today or not?
As Aguirre's Lee is set for another hearing and would have to post bail and find a third-party custodian if he is to be released. Aguirre's Lee says the whole story is one-sided from the police point of view, but the judge advised him not to speak in court without a lawyer.
There's a lot of stuff that in this case is missing.
Aguirre's Lee pleaded not guilty. Meantime, despite acknowledging that Aguirre's Lee was able to gain access to the GCI communications room in a simple, random break-in, the company spokeswoman, Megan Baldino, says security is of the utmost concern.
We place the absolute highest priority on the reliability of our network. And we had security measures in place at the time of this break-in. And of course, with any event like this, we're going to review and take the appropriate measures as a result.
GCI has no update on the status of the investigation into another outage that happened in April, also due to alleged criminal activity. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, military crews continue to look for remains at the site of a 1952 plane crash on Colony Glacier.
37 members that have been identified, a total of 52 personnel total. So there's still 15 that are left unidentified.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Pacific University works with students to maximize their credit transferability and give credit for prior work experience. At APU, your path to degree completion is outlined right from the start. Learn more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Today, the military is resuming an annual mission on the Colony Glacier, where an Air Force plane crashed 65 years ago, killing the dozens of service members on board. The plane was found during the initial search, but body recovery was deemed to be too dangerous, and the plane and its contents soon disappeared beneath the snow and ice. For decades after, nobody knew what had happened to the plane. The remains were buried, undiscovered, until an Alaska National Guard crew spotted the wreckage during a training mission in 2012. And since then, there's been a yearly recovery effort. Major Stephen McGinnis is the officer in charge of coordinating logistics for this year's mission.
Specifically, what we're doing here on the glacier is obviously recovery. So primary focus is the safety of our team. Second would be repatriation of remains. And then third would be the being good stewards of the environment. So as best we can, cleaning up the pieces and parts of the wreckage that does present itself up on the glacier.
The operation is as unique as it is challenging, involving cooperation between an array of military teams, including daily helicopter transports from the National Guard to guidance from Air Force morticians based out of Delaware. After decades in the shifting landscape, many of the service members can be identified only through small amounts of organic matter and bone fragments tested for DNA matches. McGinnis says the length of the operation will be determined by how weather and the movements of the glacial terrain affect recovery efforts.
We're up to 37 members that have been identified, a total of 52 personnel total. So there's still 15 that are left unidentified.
Earlier this season, searchers also spotted a large section of plane debris on an upper section of the glacier, which could extend the operation by a few more years. The mission's window is short, lasting just about a month, but there's also a no-fly zone set up around the recovery site, lasting from May all the way through October. That's in part to keep away sightseeing aircraft and potential boaters after an incident earlier this spring. McGinnis says it happened while the National Guard was conducting a training flight over the popular Lake George area.
There was actually some folks that were down on the glacier. They were doing some sort of filming. We had heard it was a reality show, but don't know the exact specifics of it. Really, for us, that kind of was a bit of a red flag. Like, they may not have understood that that's what we consider to be hallowed ground with the remains of U.S. service members in that area.
The operation on Colony Glacier is set to last through June 30th. An Anchorage group wants to change the dialogue about guns. On Saturday, the Anchorage chapter of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America held a march commemorating National Gun Violence Awareness Day. Alaska Public Media's Henry Leisha has more.
A group of men and women holding posters and dressed in bright orange are gathered around picnic tables along the Delaney Park Strip. They pass flowers from hand to hand as local activist Janice Swiderski leads a chant.
Safe. For kids, for you, for me.
Okay, we're going to walk. We're going to take a little walk now.
Swiderski is the local lead for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, a national grassroots organization that advocates for stronger laws and policies to reduce gun violence. Swiderski says the mass shootings that took place at Sandy Hook Elementary in Newtown and Pulse Nightclub in Orlando inspired her to take action.
At some point, you have to take a moral stand, and you have to think about public safety. And right now, I think we're having a gun violence epidemic in our country and in Anchorage.
According to the Center for Disease Control, Alaska had a gun death rate of 23.4 per 100,000 citizens in 2015. That was the highest rate in the nation that year, although a vast majority of those deaths were suicides. In Anchorage alone, 30 homicides by firearm were carried out in 2016. One of the marchers, Megan Byers, says she came out to march on behalf of her niece, who was shot by an acquaintance almost 2 years ago. The niece survived, but Byers says the issue of gun violence has become much more real to her. She wishes that gun owners understood that when she advocates for gun safety, she isn't trying to take away their Second Amendment rights.
Even after my niece's event where she got shot, you know, I went to my social media and asked for people to come out, and I surprisingly got messages from people saying, "You're trying to take away our guns." It's like, that's not it at all. It's definitely not it at all. I come from a family that has guns. I know how to shoot a gun. I know how to use it properly and safely. We store it safely. We just want some accountability from gun owners.
After making their way through downtown Anchorage, the marchers arrive at Hostetler Park, a shady corner of grass where L Street becomes West 3rd Avenue. Beneath the tree in the park is the Homicide Victims Memorial, a black stone wall that lists hundreds of Alaskans who died from violent crimes. Marchers lay flowers by the wall and list the names of family members and friends who were lost to gun violence.
Bruce Cook, my uncle. Brianna Moore. Dylan Hockley. And Daniel Barden.
While leaving the park, the marchers are quiet, but soon after, they will resume their spirited chanting and wave their signs at passing cars. In Anchorage, I'm Henry Leisha.
The University of Alaska Board of Regents wrapped up a two-day meeting in Fairbanks on Friday to address the ongoing Strategic Pathways Initiative to cut costs and focus on the university's core mission. Regents also discussed uncertainty about the state funding for the upcoming fiscal year. UA President Jim Johnson told Regents the situation is having a statewide impact.
On current and future students, on our faculty and staff, donors, all across the state. It also forces unproductive, wasteful planning, contingency planning exercises, frankly, rather than focusing in on our mission.
President Johnson says the UA system could shut down if the legislature doesn't pass a budget by July 1st. Johnson says UA officials are working with Senator Lisa Murkowski on an initiative to get land promised to the university as far back ago as 1915. He expressed optimism about it advancing, given inclusion of a federal land swap for the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority in the FY17 U.S. budget.
Since that is moving through, that has cleared the way for legislation addressing Alaska's other lands issues, including ours. And this could happen in the near term.
President Johnson says the draft federal legislation is being developed in consultation with the Alaska Department of Natural Resources.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Water on the Kuskokwim is low, and nets are coming up mostly empty. Subsistence fishermen along the entire river are reporting this same situation. Other fishermen, facing tight restrictions and cultural tension, have decided to refuse to fish. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
John Andrew is a subsistence fisherman in Kuisluk. He represents the Lower Kuskokwim in subsistence fishing on the Kuskokwim River Salmon Management Working Group.
I'm a lifetime fisherman. I'm 72 years old.
The group advises the Alaska Department of Fish and Game on management decisions, and it held its first meeting of the season on Wednesday. The meeting opened on a solemn note, with a moment of silence for Greg Ruzicka, a founding member who has left a big hole. Ruzicka died last week at his home in Bethel at the age of 61. John Andrew worked with him for decades on fish and game issues.
He accomplished a lot in this region. And we're missing him right now.
The Lower and Middle Kuskokwim had its first gillnet fishing opening this past weekend. 4-inch mesh set gillnets 12 hours from 9 in the morning to 9 at night. But when fishermen pulled up their nets, some came up empty. Many had about 3 fish. Others had none. About a dozen subsistence fishermen representing every section of the Kuskokwim River called in or showed up at the meeting to report these findings.
From downriver, upriver, and middle river area.
And they all said the same thing as John Andrew.
The water is very, very low. The lowest I've ever seen it in my lifetime.
Andrew says the water is about 8 feet lower than it usually is this time of year, and that makes fish hard to catch.
When the water's really low, the water is clear. The fish can see the net and avoid it. They can swim under it or on the sides.
It's also more difficult to find an eddy to set the net in. And with less water, the water temperature fishermen are noticing is warmer, which is another problem. The fish die fast in the net. There was another issue. The fishing opening was on a blue sky, clear day. Not good fishing weather.
We do our best fishing when it's a little windy or stormy.
Even if fishing conditions were good, there still might have been fewer fish caught than normal. Andrew says some Yupik fishermen refused to fish during the opening. The 4-inch gear that was allowed is meant to target whitefish and other non-salmon species. Managers are asking fishermen to return king salmon alive to the water so they can reach their spawning grounds during this conservation period.
And it's more like a cultural slap in the face for my people.
John Andrew says his people have a tradition to bring home what they catch. To catch and release, he says, is disrespectful. It's playing with your food. Many fishermen said they are waiting until the 6-inch mesh openings begin in mid-June to start fishing. They'll be more likely to catch salmon, and they won't be encouraged to release their kings. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
Fort Greely and Delta Junction celebrated the Alaska Highway's 75th anniversary Saturday, and one of the soldiers who helped build it. Governor Bill Walker and other state and local leaders attended a tribute to 96-year-old Leonard Larkins, one of more than 3,000 African-American soldiers who helped build the highway. KYC's Tim Ellis reports.
Leonard Larkins says he vowed 70-some years ago to never return to Alaska after serving 2 grueling tours of duty up here.
I can't remember way back then because I actually tried to put all this behind me at one time and after I left the service. It was pretty rough, yeah.
Rough because he and 11,000 other soldiers had to carve a 1,500-mile road out of wilderness in just over 8 months to open an overland supply route to deter or repel Japanese invasion. Even rougher because Larkins and about 3,500 African-American soldiers serving in segregated units had to build their sections of the road with little support and under hardships like enduring months of winter weather while living in tents.
The cold, you know, that's the biggest thing was the cold weather.
But after a five-day whirlwind tour of Fairbanks and the Delta Greeley area over the past week, Larkin's son, Bert, says his dad was feeling a lot better about coming back to Alaska.
The people here in Alaska are so nice. They've been wonderful here.
Among those offering tributes to Larkin's at Saturday's ceremony at Fort Greeley was Governor Bill Walker, who felt personal connections with him based on his parents having shared related wartime experiences.
Meeting Mr. Larkin is like meeting a member of my family. My mother came to Alaska to work with the Corps of Engineers on building the Alcan Highway.
Alcan is a contraction of Alaska and Canada, and it's the name by which many refer to the Alaska Highway. Walker says his father also served in the Aleutian Islands during World War II, as did Larkin's, who was sent there with his unit after they'd completed work on the highway in October 1942.
Building the Alcan Highway, that was not enough for Mr. Larkin. He stayed in Alaska, went on to the Aleutians in Attu and Kiska. And my father was in the Aleutian Islands in Attu and Kiska as part of the Alaskan Scouts, part of Kastner's Cutthroats.
The Alaskan Scouts, a.k.a. Kastner's Cutthroats, were a small covert unit of Army intelligence soldiers whose reconnaissance and guerrilla tactics helped force the Japanese to retreat from the Aleutians in 1943, a year after they'd invaded and occupied three islands. Walker said the Alaska Highway promoted development of Big Delta Army Airfield, later renamed Allen Army Airfield, and Fort Greeley itself, where Walker went to grade school for several years while his family lived in the area.
Thank you very much for your service to our country and certainly to this state.
Greeley Garrison Commander Lieutenant Colonel Michael Foote said the service rendered by Larkin and his fellow African-American soldiers not only helped win the war, it also helped end segregation in the U.S. military and promoted civil rights nationwide in the years that followed.
We don't have African-American regiments. Our Mexican-American units are all white battalions. We don't have those anymore because men like Mr. Larkin served their country and demonstrated the value of every American fighting man.
At the end of the ceremony, Foote and Delta Mayor Pete Hallgren presented Larkin's with a key to the city and frame proclamation thanking him for his service. Reporting from Fort Greeley, I'm Tim Ellis.
That is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dave Binninger in Dillingham, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Robert Hannon, Dan Bross, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Elizabeth Harbaugh, Henry Leisha, and Casey Grove in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. Sean Dugan is our producer and editor. And I am Zachariah Hughes. Have a great night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided for all the training programs, providing students with housing, food, books, and tools. Learn more by calling 1-800-733-JOBS. This message sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc. The University of Alaska Southeast offers the Finnish College Alaska Initiative, designed with flexible online learning options and customized degree programs. It's college that fits life, work, and play schedules while earning a degree. UAS is now offering a 3-credit tuition waiver for eligible applicants. Apply for the fall semester by Tuesday, August 1st. Learn more at finnishcollege.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.